Hey, good morning. Middle of the morning, top of the morning, I'm not sure. We're kind of in this in-between time. If you're a guest with us, whether you're visiting for the first time or it's been a while, welcome. We're really thrilled that you're here. It's happy Easter. It's quite a privilege that you're celebrating with us. There's a lot of good churches in town, so the fact that you're here means a whole lot, so thank you. And the other thing that I think is important to say is, man, if you find yourself in this room and you feel like you're the only one in the room who hasn't embraced the historic resurrection of Jesus, there's this thing that can happen if you tell yourself that too much. And I just want to acknowledge, like, lots of us, all of us have been there at some point. And it's not important to us that you pretend that we all believe the same thing. We'd certainly love for you to believe in Jesus, but it's not important to us that you do right in this instant. And so we're just thrilled that you're here and hope that this is a hospitable space for you to work out and through and toward whatever it is that you need to. And then for those of you who are here because Jesus is the center of your life, we're really, really thrilled to celebrate with you. It strikes me that I want to get us thinking about this idea of identity formation. I don't know if you've thought about this before, but it's one of those things like once you buy a Subaru, all you can see is Subarus. We can go ahead to that next slide. But have you ever considered that like everything we do is done in the name of forming an identity? No matter how good or bad, based upon whose judgment. Like the Bible opens with God saying we're made in God's image, and some would say, like we're given that opportunity, but even if we don't claim it, we spend the rest of our lives assembling an identity. And it struck me for a long time that this is, to the extent that it's true, it's particularly true in our consumeristic culture. All the logos and all the purchasing, like every shirt you buy, every pair of shoes you wear, every tattoo you get, all of it, it's all in the name of identity. I don't know if you've sat with that, but I think it's worth thinking about for a couple reasons. One, there's a guy, next slide, a guy named René Girard. He was a French philosopher who did most of his work in the late 1800s. I think he died in the early 1900s. He developed this philosophy called mimetic desire that's had this kind of resurgence of popularity. And what mimetic desire claims is that none of any of our desires is arrived at autonomously. Meaning, there's nothing in your DNA necessarily. It's not just because of genetics that you desire certain things or not other things. That every desire, you don't have to believe this, this is his suggestion, that every desire we have, it's projected to us. And we're either adopting other people's desires as they come at us, or we're rejecting them. So you're either adopting a desire that comes to you, or you're actually fundamentally doing the opposite. So like if you were raised in the home of alcoholics, then your response might not be to drink, but to actually loathe alcohol. Or if you were raised in the home of a Raiders fan, then your inclination is not to like the Raiders, but to find some other team to be a fan on. Come on, that is funny. Even though I don't have any jokes anymore because the Broncos are now the laughingstock of the NFL. It's something to think about, though. That every desire you have has a hero attached to it, or an anti-hero. And again, it comes back to this idea of to what extent are you consciously aware of part of what you're doing throughout your days is taking on an identity, the things you purchase, the people you associate with. In fact, there's another guy, A.W. Tozer, who was a CMA pastor in the mid-20th century. I had friends in my early 20s who were really big fans of his and have some familiarity with his work, and he was the king of these lists. And one of them, next slide, yeah, there we go, is this, what he called his rules of self-discovery. I throw this up here to suggest, I think these are also rules of identity. Like, what do you want most? What do you think about most? How do you use your money? What do you do with your leisure time? What company do I enjoy? Who and what do I admire? What do I laugh at? Again, what if this central biblical claim that you're made in God's image is true? And what if so much of what it means to be human is we have to get identity from somewhere else? See, the reason I bring that up this morning on Easter is it strikes me, and this is, if you just allow it to soak in, it's rather absurd. Because the fact that we're here in the Grand Street Theater in Helena, Montana in 2024, is that the year? I'm getting old, I can't keep track of the year. Yeah, 2024, it's astounding. Because what happened was 2,000 years ago, one of the unique things about the Christian faith is it's not based upon an idea, but a historic event. 2,000 years ago, this really small group of people, I mean, we think of like the Church of Rome or the Church of Constantinople as these like burgeoning groups, and they became that. But for decades, there was like 15 people in this town and 12 in this town and 20 in this town. But they did this absurd thing where they chose to build a whole identity around the risen Son of God. And whether you embrace it today or not, like you're literally in the room, because there's this long tradition of people who say, I'm not just going to believe that, I'm going to build a whole identity around like living this resurrection. And that's one of the hardest things, isn't it? I'm sure there's been other times where it's been hard to be a Christian, but it's particularly tricky right now. And what's even more tricky is how do we move this idea of Easter from this abstract concept to something that actually animates the way we live our days, like today and tomorrow, and not just at church, but like at school or on the team or as you walk the halls or as you go to work. I think that's what the readings are doing. I'm a little ashamed to admit that my least favorite Sunday of the year used to be Easter. Speaks to my own arrogance, because I always understood my job was coming up with something to say. And then when I realized, like, that the story's there, just tell the story. And it strikes me that the readings this week, I was like, we don't actually need a sermon. Like, let's just read the readings. Watch Isaiah 25. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wine strained clear. What the heck? Well, in the ancient Near East, there were these things called enthronement ceremonies. They happened at least annually. In this region of the Near East, they were celebrating the god Marduk. It was this way, think of it as like a State of the Union address or some other kind of high holy day, but it was a way that they demonstrated that the Babylonian god Marduk was king. And it came with all these festivities. Well, Isaiah is writing to a people whose world has been decimated. Most of their country has been destroyed. Jerusalem is teetering at best at this point. Many of them have been hauled off, if not killed. There's no evidence that their God is the one true God. And Isaiah has the chutzpah to say, hold on. There will be an enthronement of Yahweh. Just hold on. He is king. Verse 7, and he will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all the peoples, the sheet that is spread over all the nations. He will swallow up death forever. What is this? I think this is the God of the garden. So many religious ideas tell us that creation is bad and it's an abstraction and our job is to get through this, to get to this inanimate space, but not this religion. This God declares creation good. This text says that God made this space to dwell here with us, and then things went terribly wrong. But Isaiah's claiming to these people who were suffering, we can still build our identity around this God, because the great enemy death will be defeated. I couldn't help but think here this morning, like, I don't know if holidays are celebrated on the other side of the veil, but it is kind of awesome and astounding to think that as we, those of us who walked with Clint and Jim, like, we celebrate our first Easter without them, but what is that like on the other side of the veil, celebrating it with him? See, that's what Isaiah is saying here. Death doesn't get the last word. And then watch verse 9. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him so that he might save us. This is the Lord from whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. Here's a question that maybe moves it off the abstract. Next slide. This struck me months ago when I was thinking about these texts and thinking about Easter. Like, will I be counted among those who waited for God? Because the story that we can choose to build our identity starts way back. There was once a God who called a guy named Abram to leave what was familiar to him and to head off into this unknown space. And that led to a whole community of people being enslaved in a place called Egypt. And in Egypt, things went very bad very quickly. And these people started to cry out to God, God, rescue us, rescue us. And they had nothing to go on other than Abraham and this promise. But eventually, God sent a guy named Moses. He delivered them. We'll celebrate that deliverance through communion this morning. God delivered them into their freedom, out of Egypt, into the wilderness. And then they became a people who had their land and their space and their temple. But as the cycle goes for all of us, things got off the rails pretty quickly. And these people who had this reference point of the Exodus suddenly found themselves waiting again for God to rescue them. They called out for a new David, a new Moses. And that's where Christmas comes into this story. God showed up in these unexpected, unpredictable ways. In the same way Abram was called to go from here to there and he didn't know where there was, Jesus showed up as human and God. But then these people became a people with two reference points. Jesus, God being born, and then eventually dying and resurrecting, and the Exodus. And here's where we are. This is what it means to be Christian. To build an identity around this is our space. And it doesn't mean we don't play on teams. It doesn't mean we don't go to work. It doesn't mean that we don't have everyday, ordinary lives in Helena, Montana. But the invitation is we build the core of our identity around these people who have this frame of reference of Christmas and the Exodus, but who are looking ahead to this time when death loses, where God's desire for creation happens. And I think part of the way we can maybe demystify the New Testament actors, I don't say that they're fictitious, I just mean the people in the New Testament, is to understand that like you, they woke up in the morning and chose whether or not they were going to build an identity around those who waited. That's the three women that we meet in Mark 16. And while I can never read at the level that Anna and Jody did, let's just look at this again. It starts this way. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. There's a couple things that stand out to me as worth observing here. One is, notice all the allusions to a new day, a new week. The Gospels do this. They talk about the resurrection as like the sun was coming up again. There's this new creation happening. God has laid this parallel track that we can move over and live our life on while staying in this space. But the other thing that I think can be so encouraging to me in my faith is when they were in the midst of living it, they had no idea. They didn't have the clarity of people 2,000 years later would be in Helena, Montana, contemplating this in a local theater. All they had to go with was it just struck them that they had no idea what it means that Jesus was now dead, but they had the next right thing. And for them, the next right thing was, well, I think we honor him by taking some of these things to his body, to the tomb, and just honoring his life and death. We celebrate resurrection. They were in the midst of grief. Verse 3, they had been saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb? When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. Notice they're not anticipating resurrection. There was no party outside the tomb counting down 10, 9, 8. Nobody saw this coming. But again, I think this is for me why it's a good point of reference. All they had was the next thing. Just the next step. Verse 5, as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Wait a minute. They're looking at the face of the resurrection, and their response is what? Fear. Now, if you hang around me long enough, you'll get annoyed because I see this theme everywhere. It's kind of like that if you're holding a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I'm convinced like this theme is so central to the Bible. A God who calls us to things, and in the moment, they're terrifying, they're scary. We want to run, we feel threatened, we want to get out of there. It's unprecedented. Think of Abram. Abram, leave here, go there. What's there? I don't know. I'm just telling you to leave here. Think of Moses at the burning bush. It was terrifying. He just had this instinct of taking off his shoes. He didn't know what was next. Think of Mary. This is my favorite story in the Bible, I think, other than the obvious. Hey, Mary, the Messiah is going to come through you, but I'm a virgin. Yeah, I'm going to work with that. And what's her response? It's so honest, so human. Mary was much perplexed by his words. And she pondered in her heart, what sort of greeting would this be? Notice the duality of what she's committed to there. There's this permission to be scared and confused, threatened, taken back. Maybe I relate to this because I don't handle surprise very well. But what does she do? She stays present. She leans in. And this is so like Jesus. He's constantly saying to people, so there's a hint. Now go work on it. Go think about it. This is going to take work. See, we want a Christianity that spoon feeds us every point along the way. The problem is we don't follow a Messiah who did that. He said these things that could really only be understood if you like sat with them and wrestled with them. And part of the reason why it's so important to me that if you're here and you're not of faith, that you don't feel rushed is because many people in the story took a long time to get there. And while, yes, death is real and urgency is real, and Jesus talks about that too, there's also this, like, it takes some time for many of us. And now watch the number of times this idea of fear comes up. We've hit one. I'll finish this section. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed." There's two. "You were looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He's been raised. He's not here. Look, there's the place they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he's going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb. That's a fear response. "For terror," there we go, "and amazement," there we go, "had seized them." We're at five. "And they said to one another," and they said nothing to anyone, "for they were afraid." There's six. I wonder if one of the proper Easter responses is, what's scaring you? Because in your search for God, that might actually be the most objective answer to the question. John Townsend, Henry Cloud, a couple of the most reputable Christian psychologists I know of, they say something like, if you're trying to discern the will of God, do the hard thing, because that's often where he is. Thomas Merton, a Roman Catholic mystic, he used to say something like, if you're trying to do discern of God, head towards what you're afraid of, because that tends to be where God is. How are you afraid? Part of what I love about the Gospel of Mark, and this happened to me when I was studying for this, is the way the Gospel of Mark ends. I left this slide up here because in the oldest manuscripts we have of Mark, which aren't the original ones, but they're older and we have way more of them than we do the Iliad or the Odyssey or something like that, but the oldest ones we have, the Gospel ends here. And if you open your Bible when you get home tonight, or if you brought one with you, mine here, you'll see there's a few different suggested endings. Because for hundreds of years, scholars have debated, how is Mark supposed to end? How did Mark end it? There's one theory that because it was a scroll, the end of the scroll was lost for where? Because there's then other versions that aren't quite as old, but are pretty old in their own right, and they have this shorter ending. And then there's still other versions that have this longer ending. And I'm frankly not qualified, nor did I invest the time to even really have an opinion on how Mark is supposed to end. But I love how Mark 16:8 ends from like a spiritual direction state. Because isn't this actually the way God typically works in our life? Here's some stuff to work with. Here's some experiences. Now go work on it. Go think about it. Go investigate. Not like, here, let's rush you to these three things. No, it's going to take some work. How's God scaring you? And if you're someone that hasn't built an identity around being Christian, what's scaring you might be this idea of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm starting to believe this stuff. And that can be spooky, especially because it's a particularly difficult time to identify as Christian. There's landmines everywhere. And for you, maybe the proper response is go start doing some of the work. Justin's going to lead a book group from the book called The Case for Christ, which I think is one of those books every Christian should read. It's written by a guy named Lee Strobel. And what he does in that book is he takes a modern kind of historic metric and applies it to the resurrection to see, like, does this stand up to the scrutiny of history and actual fact? Maybe that's the next step for you. Maybe you don't have to figure out, like, what would it look like if I was baptized? What would it look like if I was believed? Just the next step. Just go investigate the next step. But for others of you, like, you're centered in Christ. And maybe for you, it's like, where's the fear? I can relate. I remember we were talking as a staff this week. If Nary lives to be 30 years old, there will be a clear chapter ending and beginning at 2020. Because in February of 2020, we were a church of 500 plus on the weekends, and that was lots of fun. And then after we came back 6 weeks later from COVID, there was like 16 people in attendance. And there's lots of reasons for that. I'm not trying to judge anybody. But that was traumatic for us as a staff in particular. I mean, it was traumatic for all of us in our spaces, vocational and otherwise. I am grateful that I spent my adulthood growing up in church planning cultures, because one of the mindsets we adopted as a church, as a staff, almost instantly was, hey, we're a church plant again. Behave like one. We actually said, like, and every business in town is a startup again, whether they act like it and believe it or not. But for me, the trick there was many of the things that I'd been learning to do when it comes to church leadership, I frankly didn't resonate anymore. It wasn't born of this need to repent of them from the past. I just felt like the missional moment had changed. So much of what I learned in my 20s and 30s was to make Jesus easy. And I actually don't believe that's true anymore. I don't see that stand up to the scriptures. It seems to me, especially in this cultural moment, following Jesus is hard. Believing something easy, building a whole identity around faithfully being among the people of God, that's tricky. And I remember in those days, many people, I said it to lots of them, and most didn't understand what I was saying. I wasn't trying to be dramatic, but I was my refrain to God on most of my walks to work for several months was, God, am I even marketable anymore? And that wasn't me feeling sorry for myself. It was just born of this, like, God, I'm aware of the fact that I'm moving away from so much of what used to be the value, and I just think there would probably be a Sunday where I show up and it's just me, and if I'm lucky, my wife. I don't say that to celebrate myself, but to just create a point of reference. God often calls us to do really tricky things. And to the extent that he's calling you to do that, that means you share company with Abraham and Moses and Mary and Gideon. People who found the will of God by heading toward the fear. And yet making sense of that will take work. You're not going to solve it this morning or probably today or maybe not even in 2024. Think about Mary, Jesus' mom. 33 years she was much perplexed by his words and pondered what this could possibly mean. So I think the invitation is, what does it look like to build an identity around the faithful people of God and the risen Son of God? And to the extent that you're trying to move towards that, where's the fear? I'd like to pray, and the band's going to come back up and lead us in a little more music. God, Lord, thanks for everyone here who comes from their own context and their own background and their own kind of just life circumstances. And God, we recognize the paradox of what it means to follow you is we individually account to you at some point, and yet we're called to do this together. And so my prayer would be that you'd meet us in this moment in our desire to build identity around the risen Son of God, that you'd help us make sense of what that looks like by really just pointing out not the thing that's 10 steps from now, but just what's the next step. We love you, Jesus. Amen.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Narrate Church, find us online at narratechurch.org or look us up on Facebook or Instagram.